right, here we are. New podcast. Great guest coming up. This week, Adam Savage, my old friend. He's been on before when he was hosting Mythbusters with Jamie Hyneman. He's on his own now doing some really cool stuff. And this conversation goes in lots of different directions, which I always love. We end up talking about science and life and raising kids. It's just a really cool conversation. And it always goes in places you don't expect with Adam. So enjoy it. Hey, folks, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you very much.
So awesome to be doing this. I'm here in San Francisco, and we're on video, too. And I'm here with my good old friend, Adam Savage, in his cave, as he calls it, which you have to see it to believe it. And you were on the show before with Jamie a couple of years ago. We had a great time, and it's been a while, and we've tried to connect in New York and San Francisco, and we missed each other, and now we're doing this, and we're going to catch up, and it's great to see you again, my brother.
I'm glad you made it.
Yeah, thank you so much for being on again. Yeah, and we were talking about all sorts of stuff, and I want to get into, you know, 14 years with Mythbusters, right?
Yeah.
And now transitioned into all this other cool stuff. Oh, by the way, I was watching you on the plane on the GE series.
Oh, yeah, with Ali Ward.
Yeah.
That was so much fun.
Yeah, you're doing the... And the thing about you that comes through is just how much friggin' fun you're having. You're like this little, like, kid, and it just... It's so infectious. You were looking at how an engine's built, and an airplane engine, a jet engine, and then these fan blades and the design of the fan blades. Yeah. And when you see those things... I mean, you almost look like you're speechless in a way at times, and it doesn't look manufactured or fake.
No, in fact, GE, who paid for that series, took Ali and I around the world to look at different GE facilities and look at the innovation their scientists are doing. And in many cases, we understood very clearly that Ali and I wanted to be kept from seeing stuff until we were actually filming.
Right.
Because we were getting access to things that you don't get to see, the casting process for those turbine blades and
right.
the machining. And, you know, we were in this room that was much smaller than I think such a room should be.
Right.
Where they're building jet engines for 747s. And there's a guy and he's got a desk and next to him is a 747 engine. And he's just slowly putting it together.
I'm going to put this out of the way so we don't miss you. Okay. How did that come about? Like, how did that GE series, because it was like 6 or 7 minute, I saw the thing about they made parts using 3D imaging with the, and you guys are touching the dust and you had to.
Yeah. And they wanted a video series showcasing their innovation and their research and development.
Right.
And they reached out to me and to Ali. And we had Ali is a wonderful science communicator. She lives in Los Angeles, and we have mutual friends, but we had not met before. And it was ideal because all they really wanted was just to see it through our eyes.
Right.
So they were a fantastic client, and we got to spend, I mean, I think the last part I did with them was we spent a week driving across northern Germany visiting a wind farm off the North
Sea.
Oh,
I saw that where they put that giant plant in the middle of the sea.
Dude, totally amazing. I mean, like, we flew the helicopter around there, and yeah, it was great.
There was, like, I think I counted, and I'm not saying this, like, just in, like, the first 2 minutes of one episode, I think you said wow, like, 7 times. And for you to say wow, you know what I mean?
I am given to hyperbole.
No, but it wasn't hyperbole. I was doing the same thing. You walk in, and it's like, and then you realize this is just one engine, and they make, and then this is just GE, right?
There's other companies, they're one of many.
It's like, and you realize just how big the world is.
So there's something I understood on that trip to northern Germany that I had not gotten before, and it was about power distribution. So in that huge box that they built, which is effectively a tool for transmuting the power that comes from the wind turbine and getting it to shore.
Right, using gas, and gas is involved.
Well, so what the gas is really, this is what I wanted to talk about because it's so cool. They're piping, they're using these giant aluminum buses, basically a giant aluminum bar to pipe the electricity through. And you need a big fat one because you're moving so many electrons. But because you're moving so much electricity and electricity likes to arc, you have to have it a certain distance away from its neighbor. And so in a power station, like when you're driving past one and you see all those towers, the distance between every wire is carefully dictated so that things can't arc. But in that box in the North Sea, and by box I mean a building 100 by 100 by 300 feet, in that box, they don't have the room to put that distance between the bus bars for electricity. So they put them inside a chamber that they fill with a non-conductive gas called sulfur hexafluoride, simply because it's non-conductive, and that's the only way they can get enough electricity through the place.
Wow.
It's mind-blowing.
Yeah.
It was like an epiphany about understanding how you move power around.
And you would think that non-conductivity is something you don't want when it comes to power,
you,
right?
You want to be able to control it.
Yes. Yeah. And do you... I want to get into something that you said. We're going to talk about you detested the site, the incognito thing, the last one, the King Arthur. Oh my God! And you got your name on the all right, and yeah, your initial. Yeah. You said the reaching out with my hands and making something I desired is the engine of everything I have achieved.
Yeah.
So where did this obsession come from for you? Going back to being a kid. I mean, for Christ's sake, I watch you. By the way, I got a DeWalt circular saw flexible. I swear to God, I just bought one. I'm a freak when it comes to tools. I grew up with my Uncle Ralph, and he was really handy, and he taught me, and I was good with woodworking and metal shops. So other kids would like to go to toy stores or sporting goods stores. I would love to go to the hardware tool department at Sears.
Both,
and he worked at Sears. He was a salesman, so I got all these craftsman tools. So I was like, I need a skill saw. And I don't really need a skill saw, but I'm like, I think I need a skill saw. And then I'm like, why would I get a wired skill saw? That's so 900 years ago.
And you can really work a good, good portion of your day with that cordless.
I bought it. Anyway, this isn't an ad for DeWalt, but I saw it. I'm like, I got the same thing. So I'm watching you. I'm digressing. Like, redo your bathroom here in the cave.
Yeah.
And it's like, this guy just likes to fucking build shit.
I do. It doesn't matter what I'm building. If I can't think of what to build, like a prop or a thing I want to make, I will just build a new rack for stock. I'll build a new shelf, a new drawer.
Do you drive your wife crazy, or does she love you for that? Or is it more like not around the house, but in your...
No, I do it around the house, too, if it's a necessary fix.
Yeah.
And sometimes, like, we have... our kitchen is an amazing kitchen. It's actually like one of the reasons we bought our house. It's an incredible kitchen, but the pots are all meant to be stored in drawers, which is weird.
Right.
So I took some really nice birch ply and made these drawer dividers that are adjustable and configurable.
Of course you did. And of course they are.
And she was like, this is amazing. So she reaps a lot of benefits from my OCD organization.
So where does this come from for you?
From the example I was given growing up. My father, Lee Savage, was a painter, an artist, who made a big splash in the late 50s, early 60s in New York. The first show he had up on Madison Avenue sold 7 paintings to the Hirshhorn and a couple to the Whitney. He's still in their permanent collection. He went on to become an advertising art director, working with the earliest giants in the industry, Seymour Schwast, Ivan Chermayev, Milton Glaser, Bob Bleckman, and all of these guys. Mm-hmm. So I grew up with a very creative household.
Right.
Around the time I was born, 67, my dad pulled out of advertising completely because he couldn't stand the toll on his soul from selling shit.
That's a great phrase. I've never heard it put that way, but that's a really great way of putting it. Yeah.
And he was a fantastic illustrator. So he was a painter, but he could also draw anything. And he took that talent and used it to animate. And when Sesame Street began in 69, I think, 70,
right.
Their axiom was one-third puppets, one-third live action, one-third animation. And my dad was one of the very first animators they hired.
Really?
So through my whole childhood, once a year, he would go to CTW, Children's Television Workshop. He'd pitch them a dozen, 10 ideas. They'd always buy 2 or 3. And that would pay our mortgage for the year. Then my dad would go to his little studio behind our house in Tarrytown, New York, in Sleepy Hollow.
Mm-hmm.
And he would ink, paint, and shoot, animate and shoot 2 or 3 30-second interstitials for Sesame Street. And then he'd paint for the rest of the year.
Wow.
And so this was the example I grew up with. Somebody who had structured their life. We weren't wealthy by any means. I was like 7 or 8 before I was able to get a Christmas present that I wanted.
Really?
Right? Yeah, we were poor. We didn't have a lot of dough. But my parents were part of that first exodus of Bohemians out of New York. So they moved from Sheridan Square to Westchester to Tarrytown in 1971.
Mm-hmm.
And those jobs for Children's Television Workshop, really, that was the first 10 years of my life.
And I will say,
my dad also did tons of stuff around the house. Like, he took the two-car garage behind our house and turned it into a painting studio. And turned it into a painting studio. He built the deck behind our house 3 separate times. It got better each time. So I grew up with the example of somebody who taught me you can manipulate your world to fit you better.
So how did that work for you? It's funny because you talked about Sarah Vowell, and she has a book. She talked about the Shakers, and one of the things the Shakers do teaching is sort of
Lafayette and the almost United
States.
Yeah,
you got to sort of make the students go find mistakes in the science textbooks. And you say the context of how it applies to you isn't really explained. You're told to hold to the authority of the teachers. So again, that just supports the idea that these facts have been written and they are what they are and they can't be changed. And right. I was really struck by that because I never thought about that, but you're right. Like, you sort of walk into this room with 30 desks and an authority figure and you go, and here's this piece of literature or writing, and whatever's in that book is what it is.
Right.
And the idea of letting these kids be empowered to find the mistake in a book makes totally colors the way we learn and the way we think we should learn.
In the right exact way. So my dad was also subversive. He was not very good with authority. I remember my sister was sick and she came in the next day and the teacher was like, well, you got to bring a note. And she's like, well, I was sick at home. And he's like, well, go to your parents and get a note. And so my dad wrote her a note that said, my daughter was sick. My daughter was absent from school yesterday because she was sick, period. A seemingly obvious conclusion.
That's awesome.
And the teacher got really pissed off, but that was like a famous family story in our family,
it's totally
right? Like,
passive aggressive.
Yes, exactly.
And you have this idea like, okay, you're 7, 8, 9, 10, 11 to live your life, but you're surrounded by kids, especially in Westchester, very traditional lives, right? Mm-hmm. Their parents have traditional jobs and they're taught to live a structured way. And did you look at that and go, boy, that seems maybe more attractive to me? Or did you feel out of place a little bit?
No, not really. I knew my parents were bohemians. Yeah. I didn't know that word, but I knew that they were different.
But you embraced that instead of...
Yeah,
like, you know.
So Tarrytown was a company town of several companies. It was one of IBM's world headquarters was there. Union Carbide also had a world headquarters. Their GM had a plant there for the longest time. So a lot of my classmates' parents worked in the plant. A lot of my teachers worked in the plant.
I think Siemens is there now.
I think they might.
Yeah, yeah.
And then I went to school with some Bonanos. A lot of the five families had their houses in Tarrytown. The burglary rate was zero.
Oh, exactly.
Oh, yeah.
Trust me, I grew up in an Italian neighborhood. And it was all Italian, and my parents had a little furniture store, so we lived in a tenement house like here and then literally up the street, and there was some burglaries going on around that time, and someone came by. This was before like cell phones and alarms or whatever. Someone's like, we think someone's breaking in the store. All of a sudden, there's 8 Italian guys and me at like 11 walking with my father, my 2 uncles, 4 other Italian guys, and all I could think is, man, if this guy gets met by these 11 guys, he's going to get the living shit beat out.
That's going to make their night. They're like, this is a party.
Exactly.
So these were the kids I grew up with, and I didn't think of anything being very different. I do remember at one point sitting in detention. Sleepy Hollow High School sits up on a hill and looks down at Route 9, the main street of Tarrytown. And I'm looking across at this building, a building, in fact, in which my mom now has her office. She's a psychotherapist. But I was looking at this building and I recognized it and I realized, oh, I recognize that building because my dad had done a painting of it and it was sitting in our house. So I went, oh, and this kid next to me goes, what? And I go, my dad painted that building. And the kid goes, oh yeah, it was painted recently. And I go, how do you know? and we're talking about painting in two totally different senses.
And that's when you realize.
You're totally coming at this from two different angles,
and neither one is necessarily better than the other. But
it was incredibly traditional. I went to school with the same kids from age 5 to 18, right?
Yeah.
North Tarrytown Public School System.
Yeah, yeah. And that's important, I think. That's nice for stability to kind of... Do you still keep in touch with those kids?
Not a single one.
Really?
Yeah, I didn't have a great time in school. I couldn't wait to get out.
Because of this sort of...
I was a bit of a misfit. I didn't... It wasn't like I was bullied. I mean, I was bullied a little bit by some assholes here and there, but everyone was.
Yeah.
It was more like... Yeah, I had to work a lot of stuff out, and I didn't really, like, I didn't really find my sangha, my people, until I moved into New York, and I'd kind of, like, calmed down after about a year of sleeping every third day and walking the city at dawn every morning.
Really?
Yeah.
It's hard for a kid at that age to sort of not have a sense of sort of fitting in or figuring out where you fit in and all of that, although it doesn't surprise me, given that you're growing up in a family like that, because I do feel like that's sort of you are the aberration in that environment that you were growing up in. It's a very traditional, Tarrytown is very, very traditional. It'd be different than growing up maybe in Austin, Texas or something like that.
I don't mean to also imply that my classmates were mean or anything, because...
Oh, no, everybody gets picked on, yeah.
Yeah, and I went to my 10-year high school reunion in 95, and I was... You know, when you go to school with the same kids for 12 years... I had a crush on every girl in that class at some point in the 12-year arc. I made my way through. I didn't kiss a single one of them, but I pined after every one, in rotation.
Knowing you, you found out some creative ways to deliver love notes through
objects. Totally did that, and got told to stop that because it was creepy.
Projectiles that go through the air.
But at my 10-year reunion, I was really pleased to note that all the women that I'd gone to high school with had blossomed into... some of the most beautiful women.
Is that right?
Yeah, absolutely. My girlfriend at the time was like, holy shit. It was great. It was lovely.
That's so awesome. So when do you sort of have that sense now you're kind of figuring it out, but now you're in college age, are you sort of starting to think, okay, I think this is where I belong. This is kind of where...
So I was all over the place. I was clever.
Mm.
In the 1970s, no one was really paying attention, so I was able to maintain a B average doing my homework in class while everyone else was reading their homework and doing the minimal amount of effort. My mom still says, I don't think I ever saw you doing homework.
Yeah, but you're obviously so bright.
Well, I mean, that got me by.
I should say so, got you by is an understatement.
But I also didn't have... A friend of mine said when I was 18 and I'd moved into Manhattan, he was like, your problem is that you have talent but no ambition. And I was like, what? And he was like, yeah, if you were ambitious, you wouldn't be here in my apartment talking to me. You'd be going, I'm sorry, George Lucas, I can't do that by Tuesday. He said, and that was a wonderful insight. He was right.
How old was this person who said this?
He was my best friend, David. He was my age, 18.
That's such a mature
observation
for an 18-year-old.
And it was totally spot on. And so I didn't find that ambition for years. I bounced around Manhattan. I kept on thinking that being clever was good enough. And come on, you're like, we all know some really absolutely brilliant people who've done fuck all, right? The world is packed with possibility that has not realized its potential.
Yes.
And we also know absolute oxygen thief mouth breathers who made gazillions of dollars, right?
So there's
no correlation between being clever and success, although I thought there was because my dad was both. And I worked at an animation studio in New York. I worked in graphic design. I then moved to San Francisco in 1990. I was 23. I got work in theater. And theater was the first, like, oh, this is theater. Like, I was a theater geek in high school, but working in it professionally was really awesome. And San Francisco in the early 90s was a great theater town.
What were you doing in theater? Were you building sets?
Well, I was doing everything. So the great thing about theater is that in entry-level theater, the threshold to entry is very low. So if you want to do a little set painting, a little scenic work, a little upholstery, a little costume.
They're happy to have people who are there to help.
Exactly.
And
if you're willing to do it for $9 an hour, go ahead. Right. Go with God.
Yeah, exactly.
And so I worked for a whole bunch of theaters, and I got a reputation that... I could solve problems that other people couldn't solve. Mechanical prop problems.
Where did that come from?
Well, I've always been mechanically minded. I've always played around, and at the same time, I was also doing a lot of sculpture. I was saying, I'm a sculptor, I'm an artist. I was in group shows all over the place. And so
did your dad have that ability to, like, or your mom sort of just fix problems? I mean, your dad obviously was very creative.
He was very mechanical. Yeah. And could see the essence of the thing.
Right.
You know, it's really about being able to hold the thing in your head. To, like, you know, take apart this, like, you pull the cover off your phone, I pull it off and I look at it, and now it's in my head, and I can spin it around and look at it later. Right? Like, that's the...
So what you're saying, you can see the outcome of what you want later, or more just...
Not necessarily the outcome, but I can make that mental image work for me as I start to modify it in my head before I modify it physically.
Yeah, okay. So you're a freak. I don't know.
But so I got that reputation. That got the attention of Jamie Hyneman, who was running a small effects shop at the time. This is like 94. And he called me up and he brought me in, and I ended up working for Jamie for 5 years. But within about 6 months of working in commercial special effects, which, you know, commercial work is very different than most other kinds of work because it's got to be done today.
Yes.
It's costing tens of thousands of bucks an hour. Right. Everyone's staring at you, and you got to do your job, and there's no time.
And there's a major committee of people that you have to get approval from.
And most of them don't like you for no reason.
Right, exactly. Right? And most of them aren't very creative people, and they all have disparate views of what this thing should be.
And it's a great training ground. And within 6 months of working for Jamie, I looked up and I realized, oh, I haven't done a sculpture in 6 months. And I thought about it and I realized, oh, it's because this work is taking all of my creative energy.
So it dawned on you that you weren't missing doing sculpting, is what you're saying.
And I made the film industry, as you know, is filled with people who say, I used to be an artist. And I was really clear with myself. I am not going to use to be an artist. I'm not going to complain about it because I'm getting all of the creative, what you get from being creative, from this business.
Yes.
And holy shit, this is the first thing I think I could call a career.
Hmm.
So that's 94. That's 9 years after I graduated from high school.
Hmm.
It took me that long to...
Yeah, but you're still only 24. If you think about life, right, like you can't... Like, you know, what's your kid gonna major in? On it, you know, just whatever. Just figure it out.
I guess the dovetailing of the enjoyment of the job with the fact that it was paying me well was the point at which I started to really bust my ass, and that's what I wasn't doing. That's, you know, like.
And why were you busting your ass? Did you feel like, well, this is what artists do?
Because I thought being clever was good enough.
This is what artists do. Artists kind of don't worry about it.
Oh, yeah, I can point to that thing and that'll work and it'll just somehow happen. And, like, you know, it takes a while to realize, oh, no, it's all up to me. It's,
well,
like,
you know, it's
if I'm going to do something creative, it all comes down to me.
And, Charlie Rose said that, you know, when he used to think early on when he was into, when he would interview anybody really great at the top of their profession, was Michael Jordan or... an architect or whoever it might be, he used to think it was just, you know, innate talent accounted for it. Like just God touched that person and unlike any other person. And then through years of interviewing people, he realized it was some of that, but mostly a work ethic that separated them and a focus.
Well, it's
of what they wanted.
Of both, right?
Right? Like, and so he gave it more. He was not giving that aspect of it enough credit.
Yeah,
you know,
it's really true. I mean, Woody Allen's really right. The 99% of success is showing up, and showing up means doing the work and killing yourself to get it done.
Right,
and making sure you've seen it. And this is really the key thing: making sure that you've seen it through. And that's like. We're both in creative industry.
Right.
And a lot of people from the outside think that means that this is easy. And
oh, God, yeah.
It ain't.
I just had
and
that
you've got it, like, in the middle of every single thing you're going to do that's creative, you're going to be like, I have no idea what I'm doing. I'm an idiot. Other people must know better than I do. Please just someone tap me like the manager and send me back to the bullpen because I clearly have no idea what I'm doing. And that is, I had to realize that was part of the process. That was actually to be welcomed. And if it was easy,
to be afraid that you're going to be found out or this isn't going to work or you're not
imposter complex hits everybody.
Yeah.
I interviewed J.J. Abrams on stage earlier this week in San Francisco, and he said the same thing. He's like, every single day I've shown up on set and thought, well, this one's going to be pretty easy. Whack! A hurricane knocks your set down or an actor vomits on camera. Whatever is going
to
happen.
Well, it's complicated. You know, Leno said to me one time, he goes, you know, I don't get paid all that money to do what I do on stage. He goes, I get paid all that money to deal with all the stuff off stage that you don't see coming or the this or the that and the complications of just sort of... And you know, like I take an acting class with this one acting coach. He's wonderful. And I go in there and it's like... It rejuvenates me because you go into this small studio space for 4 days, you know, pretty long days, and you just work on the craft of acting.
Mm-hmm.
And there's no, like, how big is your stardom or what's on your resume or are you tall enough or big enough or short enough or not old enough or too young. It just sort of cleanses you of all that bullshit and it just sort of pumps this life of art back into you.
And it's hard work.
And it's hard work, but it's work that I would do all day. And then, you know, I rant to my wife, like, and then it's like, you know, you ask two people to do things a certain way and they can't get it right. And then it's 14 phone calls and I'm spending more time on the phone calls than I am on the art. And it's like, and it's a lot harder, both in terms of the creative of what you do or I do, but also the process of the business around the creative that has to make it happen.
You have to, you end up learning your, like, as I've gotten older, I've started to understand what I need out of the process, what I need from the people around me, what I need from myself, the kind of space that I need.
And what is that?
Well, for me, it turns out that, like, if I'm not in this shop, most days I don't even bring my laptop to this shop because the internet is not something I do here except in, like, if I need to take a nap and I'm checking some email. But this shop is for building stuff. Like, it's just like I can't open my computer here.
You'd be distracted. It's a way to keep yourself from getting distracted here.
So then when I go home...
Or you have no interest in even looking when you come in here.
I really don't. And so I have an office at home. That's where I do a lot of my computer work or writing or whatever. But then when I'm home, I'm also really home. I'm with my family and I'm hanging out with them and giving them all of my attention.
Yeah.
And I get, and we get so much out of that. It's funny, I was mentioning, you know, Letterman's weird proclivities are famous.
Mm.
And I remember mentioning to him that, his art, I met his art, we did Letterman a couple times. And his art director had told me that she hadn't met Letterman. Like, she'd been working there for 6 years and she had never met him. He, like, you know, he walked the offices and you couldn't make eye contact and stuff like that. And John Hodgman was like, none of us have any idea what it's like to anchor a show that's that important to a network.
Mm.
And whatever David Letterman has come up with that he needs to be able to sit in that chair and do what he does as well as he does it, I will give him a pass.
Yeah, I've seen it up close with Stephen Colbert, you know, and I've seen him go from correspondent on The Daily Show to hosting The Colbert Report to this monster.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, there need to be lanes created. We call them lanes. Like, you know, you don't go to Stephen with that. You go to this person with that.
Right,
you don't go
right.
to Stephen. And one of the adjustments, and I don't want to speak for him, is, you know, I'm a very hands-on person. You're a very hands-on person. And Jon Stewart had this thing about, when you have a show and your name's on the shingle and you're hosting the show, you have to have your foot on the throat of the show at every moment. In other words, every little detail has to be focused on and accounted for. Otherwise, the show gets sloppy, it gets this, it gets that.
Yeah.
But you can do that when you're talking about a four-day-a-week, half-hour show. When you're getting into, which is about 84 hours of programming a year, which was with The Daily Show and The Colbert Report. But then when you get to CBS and you're talking about 202 hours of programming, you've got to delegate. But you're right. You've got to kind of find some bubble or way to exist to be able to pull that off with all of those things and pressures on you and around you and from all these different perspectives.
So it's great that we're talking on this because, you know, it's been 2 years since MythBusters wrapped.
Right.
Pretty much exactly 2 years.
Mm.
And I've spent a tremendous amount of time here in the shop making stuff for myself, making videos about making stuff, traveling around the world, interviewing other makers, visiting movie sets, talking to the craftspeople, working on my website, Untested. But the other thing that I've been doing is I've been watching my work patterns and my creativity patterns. And I've been, you know, I will go back to television. I will do another show. I'll produce them for myself and for other people as well. And I'm really thinking about how I want that team to be, right? What I want that enterprise to feel like. And so I concentrate as much on the concept of show ideas. I concentrate just as much on that as I do on how I want it to feel at work.
Right.
How I want it to feel collaborating with the people.
Well, that's the show. That's you being a showrunner of a show and sort of how the how to build the process so that you're getting. I mean, what?
So, Naren Shankar, who's the showrunner for The Expanse, and he comes out of Roddenberry's writing room on Next Generation, which was run like a family, and Naren does the same thing on The Expanse. And I love talking about this, but Naren said, "You get to set the culture."
Right.
And that's such a gift because you can create one based on love and excitement.
Yes.
Or anything else. There's lots of examples of all the others as well.
And I've been in environments of both. And, you know, one where it's sort of run by oppression in a way and fear.
Yeah.
And that works for some people as managers. That's just, it's not my cup of tea. I've been a showrunner on a couple of shows that I created. And, you know, really what you want to try to do is you want to make your art and make whatever it is you're making as good as possible. But also, you want those people around you to come out of that process better than when they came in and improve both in terms of, I think, themselves professionally and personally. I always felt like sort of an added responsibility, which I welcome, to make it as nurturing, but also, you know, pretty much, hey, we're going to do this 800 times until we get it right. And I think that's as important as being creative is sort of as a showrunner is understanding that you have that obligation to those people that work for you.
Well, and I the jobs that I lasted at, one of the great privileges my parents gave me, probably the most important one, I didn't go to school, I didn't go to college, I spent 6 months at NYU pretending to study acting and then I dropped out. And my parents were pretty cool about helping me with my rent. Probably until I was about 23. Not every month, but frequently.
Yeah.
And that afforded me the ability to be working at a job that was shitty and say, you know what, I quit. Because I'm not learning anything here. That's the main thing. I'm not learning anything here, and these people don't like me or each other, and I don't like them.
Right.
And that's not an environment I feel safe in.
Right.
And so the idea that I could potentially create environments that are healthy, that are ones that young me would have liked to work in, is so thrilling.
Yeah.
Right? Like, when you're young, you look around at all the other people at your job, and you're like, everyone's competition. And then you get older, and it's like, all of a sudden, your assistant on one job hires you for another. And then you have the opportunity to hire one of your former bosses, right?
Right.
And the moment you've hired your former boss, you're like, fuck, I need to be nice to everybody because you have no idea how this is. I have signed an autograph for someone and I've thought to myself, one day they may reach down and pull me out of a gutter.
Yeah.
You never know how life is going to go.
Exactly. So when you started Mythbusters, running a TV show, doing a TV show completely new to you, so how were you then in that capacity as a showrunner boss? And then how did you evolve? And when
it was
you left,
totally organic and very slow, and which was a really nice education. We were hired talent at the beginning. Mm. The show was conceived by it was a brilliant idea, an Australian filmmaker, and Jamie and I were hired talent, and we kind of did what we were told. For a while.
Mm.
And then I started to have really clear ideas about narrative structure and story and how these things were going to go. And I started to put that in. And over the 13, 14 years of Mythbusters, I learned.
Did you get pushback initially on that from the.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely. But not a ton, which is great.
Yeah.
You know, look, it wasn't. The first few years of Mythbusters weren't easy. I won't go into great details about it. But, you know, there were some really difficult times.
See, but I think a show like that, like a Daily Show or a Colbert Report, I think the person in the chair, if you will, in front of the camera, needs to be either the creative driving force or one of the key creative driving forces. Because I think that if it's just stuff put in somebody's mouth, there's a, it, you can, the viewer can
totally
sense
can, yeah.
That there's just a little, it's not like quantifiable. It's not like, see, he's not connected. There's just a vibe that doesn't happen when it's a connection to the material.
There are, we both know of people who are inordinately good at reading something on camera and seeming clever, yeah. who are absolutely disconnected. The moment they're done reading that prompter, they don't remember a goddamn thing right, that they've
exactly.
said.
Exactly.
But so when you're the talent on a show, and Mythbusters became a hit.
Yeah.
When you're talent on a show that's a hit, you have this really weird kind of power. You are still an employee, but no one's going to give you any bad news, number one. And you can, if you want to, call the head of the network. Like, you can get him on the phone. But then the question is, what do you do with that power? I mean, you can, you know, pull your dick out and, like, you know, demand all sorts of stuff. And, you know, Hollywood is an example of how much they'll coddle to that stuff.
Yeah, exactly.
What I used it for was learning how to build this show. So I just executive produced a show for a protege, a friend of mine.
Mm-hmm.
And I was thinking, what is the one piece of advice at the outset of this pilot we're making that I would have wanted to know?
Hmm.
And I realized it's this. Don't take stupid ideas personally.
What you mean, stupid ideas?
So here's what
given to
no.
You,
here's what I mean is you're the talent on a show,
right?
And it's based on you and your enthusiasms, mm-hmm. and other people are going to come to you and go, "Wouldn't it be great if you did this?" And like their idea is so terrible, you're like, "I'm not even sure I should look at you again," right? And you get angry about it. You're like, how could you suggest that? And you realize that's not the point.
Do you not see my awards?
Right? Well, no, it's also just like that's a. At one point, Discovery was like, "We have some great ideas for boat myths," and we're like. Oh, okay, what? And they're like, apparently it's bad luck to have bananas on a boat. And we're like, have you even watched our show? The show on your network? Your flagship show? That's a terrible idea. And they're like, okay, we got another one. We pulled the office, we have some great ideas. Okay, here's the second one. Apparently it's bad luck to have women on a boat. And we're like, this call is over. But the real trick is... You have to take that stupid idea and realize that it represents their attempt to solve a problem for you. And that's where you're getting mad. You're getting mad because they're trying to do your job for you. But all you need to do is go, oh, what problem are they trying to solve? I can solve that better. So when I would get an outline for one of our episodes that included like, and then they do this experiment that doesn't make any sense at all and is totally ancillary or orthogonal to the plot.
Right.
You go, oh, I see. Right, we have this fairly linear structure, and we don't have we're light by about 4 or 5 minutes in our outline.
Right,
so we're gonna need some color here. Okay, I'm gonna add it here. I'm gonna wear a costume here, and we're gonna go to a different location for this one because I know we'll get more color out of that. Problem solved, and that's the education I got on Mythbusters was right. to be able to see through the suggestion for what the suggestion is attempting to achieve.
But this is how brilliant you are. You also learn how to tell a story visually. And what people seem to forget about all forms of the visual medium, whether it's film, acting, reality shows, television, your show, is you're telling a story.
Yeah.
And
it holds to the same rules as a screenplay,
right,
as a book.
Right.
As a,
And the words, while, you know, important, the visuals are equally important, and when you really become facile with it, you can tell a story. The fun challenge becomes, how can I tell the story with as few words as possible?
Well, it becomes like that thing of when you stand in front of a great Renaissance painting, and you realize that your eye is moving on train tracks that the artist laid out for you to tell a linear story in a single image.
Right.
And so that was the other great education on that. Throughout the show, if you watched it in order, you'd see towards the end much more delineated bright numbers and lines on camera where you could see, oh, something's going to move from there to there. I draw arrows. And all of that was because I wanted every single camera angle to tell the story of the experiment we were conducting.
Hmm.
That was the goal.
Hmm.
And
so now you're a filmmaker.
So I'm looking at
the GoPro shot.
Yeah, yeah, I'm looking at a GoPro shot, and I'm like, my eye just sees a cacophony. So let me take out that cacophony and put a bright orange line up the middle of it. Let me draw a big blue circle here. Let me frame this so that it's half of this and half of that.
So how did you train yourself to do that? Was it just from doing it and then watching playback of the show and edit and post-production and then just sort of over time going, you know, if I had to do that show again, I would do that differently and I would have done it this way?
It's a little of all of that, but it all comes from, one, growing up with an artist, with an artist's eye.
Right.
Specifically, having spent 3 years doing graphic design was super important because graphic design, you know, the, like, I learned graphic design in the year, in the just before computers hit. So we were still penciling in blue pencil the rough outline of a page and then estimating how much text it would be and taking a picture and sitting there and blurring it and holding it away from you. And again, even in graphic design, it's the same thing. Your eye needs to go to the places it needs to go. It's storytelling in an image.
See, now I would never think of it that way.
It was fantastic education
for that. And so, is there anything that you never could quite get your head around during the time of the Mythbusters in terms of more the production, maybe the storytelling, or just anything in general where you never felt like, not necessarily a particular myth that you wanted to bust per se, but just sort of more the process of the art of doing a show
Our production company is Beyond Productions out of Sydney, Australia. For many years, they made that great show Beyond 2000, a magazine-style show that ran all through the 90s.
Mm-hmm.
And Beyond did all the editing for Mythbusters. So the editing was done off-site. We sent them rushes. We talked a lot to the editors on camera, said, here, I'm shooting this sequence in three ways, so you can cut it in three different ways if you need to. But I never sat through the edits of Mythbusters. I never got to see the show being put together by the producers. And so on this show that I'm executive producing, this pilot, it's been fascinating to be party to the process of layering in, right? Like, so that first cut is weird and janky and some of the jokes don't hit, and then you go in and you layer and you layer and you layer and you refine and refine and refine, and watching a show come out of the edit room is so much fun.
Yeah.
It is the one thing I never got to enjoy on Mythbusters that I'm really digging.
Well, it's a form of art, you know, and you've expanded yourself in that way.
Scorsese says that editing is the only thing that separates film from all the other art forms. Film and television use all the art forms. They use painting, they use acting, they use performance, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. But editing is specific to that medium.
Right.
That linear cutting of, right?
It's funny, a thrilling thing. My acting coach, we were talking the other day in class, and he said, he was talking about Woody Allen. You know, one of his actors was on a Woody Allen set, and the art to telling a joke, especially in a scene, is to not move on the punchline, right? So if you have actors that don't do a lot of comedy and the punchline is, and I said, get me the mayonnaise, sometimes they'll go, and I said, get me the mayonnaise, where it's got to be, and I said, get me the mayonnaise, right? So what Woody would do to work around that is he'd just say to them, look, just don't worry, just do the lines, but when you get to that one word, just don't move your head. And then I'll worry in post-production about making the timing work by punching in on a single of you for the word, so he's making the joke work in the edit.
Yeah.
So it's two shot, one shot, and then when it's going to come to me, it's just a, so because he said, I think what was happening was they were doing it again, and your head's got to be like that, and if Woody finally figured out, just let me get the shot of you,
We're always saying that film is a collaborative art form, but I don't think anyone realizes how much editors have to do with acting performance.
Oh, God.
Every pause, every cough, every last thing, I mean...
And a good editor makes your life as a producer or showrunner so much easier, because you get that first pass and it's pretty close. You have a shitty editor, man, and it's a long...
You don't even know where to begin.
And it costs
you
more.
It's like I made this messy room messy in a totally different way.
Right, exactly.
Go.
Where's my film?
You were supposed to clean the room, not make it messy in a different way.
I can't even step over anything. You said the last season of Mythbusters was a 13-episode love letter to the fan and crew, but you were ready to kind of let it go, right? It must have been bittersweet, but it wasn't like you were going kicking and screaming because...
No.
No, you already had other things in your mind that you wanted to do, and...
It was a perfect confluence of... Look, we were at the end of a contract.
Mm.
Our ratings certainly didn't justify Discovery wanting to re-up and pay us a whole bunch more.
Mm-hmm.
We'd been doing the show for 13 and a half years. Mm-hmm. We were tired.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, and to be
clear, you said we had a couple of weeks off every 3 months,
yeah,
and that was the most we could accommodate. My whole life was structured around how we shot the show. So to have it not structured around that was destabilizing, talking about it was done.
Yeah. So we 200 plus shooting days a year for 13 years.
Oof.
Right?
Yeah.
I mean,
I'm surprised you're still married.
Unmitigated amount.
Maybe that's
of fun.
Why you're still married, because you're well, those, around
those
so
two,
no, I'm just
so those 2 weeks every 3 months were part of what I did with the power that I had as talent. The first thing I saw that I wanted to do with that power was push our schedule and increase the length of time it took to shoot the episodes.
So you had better quality episodes.
Better quality episodes, but also more time to do it. And when we renegotiated our final contract in 2010, our last 5-year contract, Discovery goes, we got to hand it to you. No one's ever come to a negotiation asking for less episodes per year. We really did.
Because you wanted to have more time.
We wanted
to
have more time to do them. We wanted to have more time with our families.
Yeah.
I mean, we shot 200 days a year, but most nights I was home by 6 o'clock.
Yeah.
And that was driven by Jamie and I and the necessity of not killing yourself.
Yeah.
Because you can't survive. We did a first season was 26 weeks of 6-day weeks.
Mm.
And we were like, we were shooting each other with airsoft pistols just to feel something.
I'm alive.
Exactly.
Did how you know your wife as a your wife said quote, you are still totally manic. I realized, oh, that's because that's the only way I know how to work.
Yeah.
This was coming out of the show.
That was the first 2 weeks. So we wrapped in November of 2015. Immediately next day after we wrapped, Jamie and I went out on our final Mythbusters Behind the Myths tour.
Mm.
We did like 25 cities. We finished up in late December, or mid, just before Christmas. Mm. My mom and my family came into town. So we had Christmas, the holidays, New Year's. January like 3rd is the first time I have off and nothing to do in 13 years.
And how is it?
And it was terrible.
So funny, the arc of you, because the 23, 24, 22-year-old bouncing around Mr. Bohemia like, yeah, and then your friend at whatever 18 saying, you should go have George Lucas tell you to get something done by Tuesday. And now you're this whole, you've transformed.
Yeah.
It's fascinating.
I will tell you that I was kind of ready to freak out because at the beginning of the previous
freak year, out in the sense of like not knowing what to do with yourself.
Yeah. Is that the previous January? So the January of 2015, we're still like 9 months left of Mythbusters to shoot, and I was doing a thing called Thrilling Adventure Hour here in San Francisco.
Mm-hmm.
My friends Ben Acker and Ben Blacker did this live old time radio stage show for a decade at Largo, and mm-hmm. they took it around the country, and they would come to San Francisco, and so I was a guest on that show. And one of their regular company players is Padgett Brewster, who's just an amazing actress, mimic, wonderful person, incredible comedian. And she was like, oh, sweetie, the show's ending? And I said, yeah. And she was like, you're going to lose your mind. And I was like, really? And she's like, yeah, I was on a show for 6 years. And the last 5 months were a nightmare. And she's, you're going to be totally destabilized by how much it'll change your reality. Just get ready. And it was such a grace that she gave that to me, because round about like 2 months left, I started getting cranky about weird things that didn't make sense. My mood changed and I got, you know, you feel out of place when we hate. It's like if there's one thing that typifies us is that we tell stories that's different than I think any other animals. I don't know. We may find that orcas have great jokes.
I heard
we tell stories and we hate change.
Yes.
Humans hate change, yeah. Even if it's for the better. That's why a lot of people will choose their miserable relationship.
Stay for 40, especially our parents' generation or whatever. Yeah.
We hate change. Change is complicated. Moving is awful.
Right.
And so the change from doing Mythbusters to the post life was really, really...
So what kind of a mood were you in? Were you just fidgety? Were you anxious? Were you cranky?
I was used to fitting in all of the stuff I do in the cave into the corners of Mythbusters.
Right.
I was like, we got to figure out what's going on. We got to figure out what's next. We got to get the next thing going. And my wife was like, I think you're wrong. I think all you need to do is to do the things that you want to do and are important to you, and the rest will fall into place.
So was that because you were now this different Adam Savage who's driven and needs to achieve the next thing? I mean, I would imagine, and I don't want to make personal stuff, but financially, I'm sure you were okay and whatever.
I was okay, but I don't get residuals because it's basic cable.
Oh, right.
So, I was getting paid for my work, but nothing else.
Yeah, yeah.
So there was a little bit of that. There was a little financial panic. But more it was like, what I knew, even though I wanted the break, what I knew was constant work.
Yeah.
That's what I knew. And I had to really meditate and relax and change. So, at one point, again, a couple months in, my wife was like, "You really got to bolt out of bed at 8 a.m. and run over to your cave? It's a block away from our house. Do you really need to?" She's like, "How about this? I'll tell you the mornings when I don't need to leave the house until 10, and maybe we can hang out." And I was like, that is the best idea I've ever had.
Your wife's very cool. She reminds me of my wife.
She's amazing. She is my true north, my compass.
Yeah, that's what my wife is like. She just is like, she has this way of okay, just... I don't think you need to look at it that way.
She also has my wife has a moral center that is so quick. I'm like a container ship. I take a long time to turn and understand that someone's insulted me or that something isn't right and I have to think about it overnight. And my wife is instantly right or wrong. And she's right all the time, right? Yeah. And that is an incredible gift to have.
Yes.
Right? Because every spouse, I don't mean men having women as spouses, but every spouse is a Lady Macbeth for the other spouse.
Yes.
Right?
Absolutely.
You're their champion. You're the one telling them, this is what you do, baby.
And they're also your protector.
Right.
And they see, and you being the artist, and I think same with me, sort of like you're kind of in our cloud of our thing, and you're not sort of seeing that other stuff clearly because you were in this good haze, if you will.
Well, the other thing that has been a great gift is, like I said, Mythbusters, most days we were home by 6. So I was really clear at the very beginning, I don't want to do this show and have missed my kids growing up. My kids were 4 when they started making the show. And I didn't. And my wife is not their mother. I divorced their mom. We get along great. She lives a few blocks away from me.
Mm-hmm.
But my wife has been around in my boys' lives since they were 3. And by every measure, she is also their parent.
Mm.
But being a step-parent, she has a view on them that it has a distance that has been so
important. Oh, that's interesting. I never thought of that about step-parents.
Because we're parents, man. Our kids, we're such suckers for our kids. I mean, in the best and worst ways.
I know.
And to have a little bit of perspective on that, there's been many ways in which she's been the one with the clearest eyes on where the boys were at that moment in their lives. Mm. At one point, one of my sons gave her a birthday card, and the cover was a Swiss Army knife.
Hmm.
And inside he wrote, "You are the tool that I use the most."
And that's incredible. Yeah.
That's really, really special.
Up. Yeah.
And so I feel really lucky that I got to raise them with their mom.
Yeah.
And my wife, all in the same neighborhood.
Well,
all
but you, the same. You luck a little bit. I think it's you having your head screwed on straight and knowing that, we have kids same age and it's like, it's so cliche, but I don't know where it went. I was looking through my phone the other day for a picture and then all of a sudden there's a picture of my son when he was 4. And I literally had to race past it because I almost started crying. I'm like, what the fuck?
Yeah.
I'm on the road on the weekends, whatever. But then summers, certain big holidays, like most comics work, I won't work because it's I'm not going to get those summers back to go see him play baseball or whatever, or do take him to this or do that. And, the other stuff will be there,
I guess shortly after we moved here back into this house in the Mission District, my son was 10 or 11 years old. And he came upstairs from a nightmare. He's like, "Can I sleep in your bed?" Mm. And I was like, an 11-year-old boy is a sweaty mess, right? At 11, they start stinking, and they're just absolutely disgusting. I mean, teenage boys gave me so much respect for teenage girls because I had no idea what they had to work with until I had to live with 2 teenage boys.
Now I know why all of my overtures were rejected.
Right,
I was a disgusting teenage boy.
But so my first response was, "No, go back down. You'll be fine. It's going to be fine." And then I realized, I think this is going to be the last time he sleeps in our bed. He's 11 years old. Can't be. Okay, yeah. Come on in. And yeah. So there's that very rare parental thing of I got to savor that transition.
Yeah, and I was funny. I was thinking that because you know my wife is like, you know, he's moving into another phase of his life, and he's and what hit me was like, well, he's not going to need me to help him fix something so much anymore, and I'm going to.
Right.
That was like a job that I really liked. Like I really liked being the guy that would. Parent that could like make something better, you know.
Well, I'm getting both now.
Oh,
I'm
getting, okay.
One son is calling me for help, and the other doesn't want to hear from me.
Yes,
I'm getting both. So actually, so like I said, I interviewed J.J. Abrams in a dinner before the interview. We were talking about our kids, and I was like, "How do your kids respond to you?" I said, "JJ's a good joke teller." I said, "How do your kids respond to you?" Because I've got two, and one worships me, and one doesn't give a shit. And JJ goes, "All my kids worship you."
That was it.
But it's very so. One of my kids is very much a teenager, and very much asking for his space and being distant. And I'm finding it really complicated.
Yeah, my son's doing that a little bit, and I don't like it. I just sent him a text last night, and the text reads as follows. When I tell you to call me, you call me, or I will pull you from the school. I've left you three messages. Unacceptable. And I left him that message after a few cocktails at 2 o'clock in the morning. But I was ripped shit, and I still am. And you know what? The idiot hasn't called me. I'm like, what? And I just wrote that for
it's
you.
It's totally important for them to do this too, right?
Yeah, my wife says that. Don't give me that bullshit.
They're killing you.
They're
stabbing you and making fun of you.
My wife says you got it. My wife is so much better. Like you were saying, like she's like the true north. She's like, this is his time. And I'm like, but I don't like it.
No, it's dead. So at one point, my boys are about 15. And my Julia pulls me aside and says.
This is your wife.
My wife. Mm. She says, I know that you think you're taking this well, but I'm here to tell you that you're not taking it very well. You need to give your kids more room at dinner to make fun of you, to tease you, to take you down, and to insult you.
Really?
Like, that is a necessary part of their development.
Necessary part of their development.
I worshipped my dad.
Yeah.
And I remember him telling me at 19, well, all parents disappoint their kids. It's part of the process of being a kid and being a kid. Like, we all eventually will disappoint our kid in some fundamental way. And I thought, crazy, you're amazing. And, like, he was totally right. And I loved having that perspective from him. So I've tried to give my kids exactly that perspective.
Yeah.
Saying, you know, look, some of the reason we just yelled and screamed at each other is because of this feedback loop that develops in a family dynamic situation.
Right.
That you can't necessarily, you can know about and not even change.
Sure.
That's the weirdest part about, again, growing older is like you can see yourself in so many lights and you're like, wow, I can know exactly that I'm fighting with my wife for some dumb reason,
right.
But somehow I can't stop
myself. Exactly. It's like you're in my life. This is like I actually said to my son at one point, I'll buy you a car if you stay around. And he's like, he looked at me, I'll get you a nice car and I'll get you set you up with an apartment. It's just like,
do I need a car in New York for?
And it's like, exactly. I even suck at bribing people. It's been an adjustment. So I want to talk to you real quick about Tested and the site and what you're doing. And if you haven't seen it, go see it. It's tested.com. And
hundreds of hours of builds and interviews and reviews and visits to sets and amazing makerspaces.
Was this a brainchild, something that you had been sort of percolating while doing Mythbusters, or did it come organically out of Mythbusters and you wrote that down going, oh, you know what, note to self, this could be a good platform or something?
I knew that I wanted to develop an online platform, and I was working during Mythbusters with a company in Los Angeles run by Lloyd Braun called Whale Rock Industries. And Whale Rock is a media company that is attempting... Everyone knows that media in general is coughing up blood and is radically shifting.
Right.
And no one knows where these dominoes or chips are going to land.
Where the plates are going to settle, right?
Whale Rock who produced both BattleBots for two seasons and built the Kardashian apps, is attempting to be a media company that will be wherever the chips might land.
Right.
And it's that's really
covering
brilliant.
Your bases. Yeah. Yeah.
So that's exactly the kind of innovative ideas that made sense to us. And they bought a company called Whiskey Media that included Tested.com, which was at that point being run by Norman Chan and Will Smith. Not the Will Smith, a white bearded dude named Will Smith. they brought Jamie and I in to test it, and then Jamie left after we finished MythBusters. He didn't have much of an interest in it. But over the last 5 years, we've been, with Whale Rock's incredible support, been able to develop Tested in this really slow, organic way into a celebration of all things making. So when we do gadget reviews, it's not just about the gadget and how cool it is. Yeah, we'll talk about that, but we'll also talk about how good a tool it is to use, whether you're using the H6 to record your podcast or using an iPhone to shoot slow-mo. It's about creating.
You're giving, it's almost like it's exploring the how, but also a consumer review at the same time.
Sure.
Kind of, yeah.
For me, I don't say making doesn't have to be physical. I keep running into people who say to me, I don't make, I'm just a coder. And I'm like, coding is making.
Right.
You're creating something from nothing. You're
right.
You're creating problems for yourself
right.
to solve.
Right.
That's creativity. I don't care whether you're singing or writing poetry or doing
right.
interpretive dance or putting rocks in a circle in the desert that no one's ever going to see. It's
right.
all the same
yeah,
thing.
Yeah, yeah. It's really important to you to sort of what comes through all of your work. Just everything is an experiment, and everything is about action and reaction for me in watching you. Like if I go on Tested and I'm watching you be King Arthur at Comic-Con, and you're like a fucking six-year-old kid. You're so excited, and English did the... Right?
I got English to go to Terry English's shop in Cornwall, England, and he took me on as an apprentice for 8 days.
Famous armor maker, right?
Yeah.
And you
he
helped him?
Armor for Excalibur and all the Harry Potter films. And
it's
aliens.
Aluminum and the thing's plastic. Are those the things right there? Those plastic chain things? Those look
that's plastic chain mail. Right, you're right. Absolutely nice.
Yeah.
Well spotted.
So I saw that. I'm a little bit of a nerd at times.
That plastic chainmail is actually developed by Weta Workshop for Lord of the Rings as lightweight chainmail for the actors.
Oh, Jesus. See, so when I watch all of this, just you like going through as the bear, and so you dressed as like a 7-foot bear.
And I dragged the carcass of Leonardo DiCaprio behind
me. It was hilarious, and people were looking at it like... And the best part of that, though, was when you, at the end of every one of these, you haven't seen them, you come off the elevator, and then you do a sort of a recap of what happened. You take the part of the thing, and you're in the room, and you talk. But as you walked up the elevator as a bear, there's a woman just comes out right after you in a black dress and looks at you like... And then just keeps going. Watch it. I don't know if you've seen it, but it's like hilarious. She's looking at you like,
Jake.
Yeah, it's like, that's a guy in a fucking big bear costume. Okay, I'm going to go get lunch. And she just peels off that way. But even you talking about, you know, I found when I was in the bear costume, I just naturally walk like this. Like, so I'm watching, and everything that you do is an analysis of action and reaction to me. In whether it's the bear costume or it's building a plane engine or whatever it might be.
So we have a lot of we have a lot of cultural misconceptions. I'm going to speak to the U.S. because this is where I was born and raised.
Right.
And they exist all over the world, but in the U.S. we have a lot of misconceptions. We think science and art are at opposite ends of a pole, and they are so not.
Right.
We think that an artist has a vision and then realizes that vision. And nothing could be farther from the truth. So, like, when we tell that story to each other, like, Michelangelo said that to make David, he simply took away all the parts of the marble that weren't David, right? That's a great little rhetorical flourish, but it's total horseshit. I guarantee you that as he was making it, he changed positions of arms and muscles and movement and places on it. It is an organic process. The thing that happens with creativity, and creativity is anytime you're creating something out of your brain.
Mm.
The fact is that you're never going to end up where you thought you were going to end up.
Hmm. Yes.
The path. This is what we mean when we say we need to teach kids how to fail. We don't mean real failure. Real failure is like getting drunk and missing your kid's bar mitzvah. That's really fucking up. We mean you have to be awake to the path that is going to take you in a different direction than you expected.
And not look at that as quote unquote failure, but as in the traditional sense of the word.
Look, that has been one of the most rewarding things about watching Colbert and The Late Show over the past couple of years is watching that show organically change to understand what itself is.
That's exactly right.
Right?
And that it was searching itself.
You're never
and he was
done.
Searching.
No. That's going to change as the culture changes, as Stephen changes, as the crew and the writing room, and all of those different things are going to modulate and attenuate that to different things. And there's going to be times you wake up and you look and you're like, everything I've done is shit. I need to start from scratch.
So I was going to ask you then, are you saying so when a person, whether it's a sculptor or a Stephen Colbert or Adam Savage, whoever it might be, a plumber who's trying to figure out a certain way to plumb a house that he hasn't done before, if that person is hitting a dead end, you can't look at it as failure. You got to look at it as, oh, something or the universe is telling me I got to go a different direction.
Yeah, that's it. It's just
But I don't think our education system teaches us to think like
that. No, it doesn't. It doesn't, and that's problematic. Look, it could be that because one of the theories I've read from the left is that our education system was built by a bunch of capitalists to train workers for the future, and you don't want them thinking creatively, so we didn't build an education system that helped that. Right. That's one possibility. I don't really care what the origins are, but for me, when I with the Obama administration, I traveled around the country promoting maker spaces and maker culture and helping people understand what it really was about. Mm-hmm. And to me, what it's about is every time you set out to do something and it doesn't go the way you expected, but it ends up either better or worse, hopefully better, but a lot of them are going to be worse.
Right.
You're learning a path it's the reason we create. We create not because the end product is great. It's because that path is so fascinating. Right. And you're like, how the fuck did I get here?
Right? I've never seen you get really pissed off when something didn't work when I've watched
you. Oh, I totally have, though. But, and we've actually covered it here. I did some spacesuit parts here on Tested, a one-day build that took 2 days. And at the end of the first day, I had screwed this part up so many times that I went home and I thought to myself, I'm sitting in the bath, livid about how much time I'd wasted. And I'm like, God, you're an idiot. You don't have any business making stuff. I had that thought, which is a ludicrous thought.
Yes.
It's totally has no bearing in reality. And I knew that, but I also knew that I had to go to this dark place right now. And I'm not had to.
But I do the same thing. How do you get yourself out of that?
I went back in the next day and I kept on doing the work. And then I did a piece to camera about it. And I was like, that got really dark for me. And this is the thought I had. And I just want everyone to know that there's no amount of success or money or accolades that insulate you from that, nor should they.
Yeah.
The imposter complex hits absolutely everybody. And the more we could talk about that, and that's important culturally to allow.
I think it frees up your creativity and gets the shit out of the
way. It does. Like, I know that 70% of the way into any build, I'm going to feel like I have no idea what I'm doing. Just almost every single build, that's going to happen. So now when I get there, it doesn't make it any easier.
So you're walking in with a knot in your stomach.
I have no idea what I'm doing. All right, just keep on doing the thing that's in front of me. Keep on sewing. Keep on adding rivets. Keep on...
But isn't it amazing that it works out? Why does it work out in your opinion?
I have no idea. That's like a mystery of our sentience.
Does that speak to sort of the indomitable spirit of man? I'm gonna see this through regardless of outcome. Or
I think that my personal feeling is it has to do with having an open heart. Because everything we've been saying about making stuff could also apply to relationships, right? Hmm. We have a happily ever after culture, but there's no such thing.
Right.
There's no fate that's the reason I'm with my wife. I'm with my wife because we both really respect each other and work really hard at living a life that is of balance with each other. And when I say work hard, I mean it's hard work. Hmm. There are times when it's amazing.
Yeah.
Most of the time it's amazing. There are also times when it's really awful and really complicated.
Right.
And the only way through that is to have an open heart and to be willing to look at yourself for all your warts. Mm. And the same is true in the workshop and the same is true in the writer's room.
Mm.
What am I not bringing to the table here? What more? Actually, I love this. At the end of, I think, season 2 of House of Cards, when it looks like Kevin Spacey's character is about to be cut off at the knees by the president, and his wife says, cut out your fucking heart and put it on the table in front of him. Wow. And it's a great axiom for how to get through anything.
And what is that? And that means for you to...
For me, it means...
Put the ego aside.
Put the ego aside.
Be honest about where how you feel.
Yeah. Accept. I don't want this day to be like this. Well, fuck you. This day is like this. You're just going to have to suffer through this.
So just acknowledge it and move on.
Life is, is this.
Yeah.
And so...
And if you do that, and if you say, look, this isn't going well, and if you even say it to camera, in some way it frees you up of that sort of thing that's eating away at you. Like, why? I'm not successful. This isn't happening. I suck at this. Why am I doing this?
I'm talking to both past me and I'm talking to future me.
Hmm.
And in talking to future me, I'm also using this lovely platform I have to help other people understand. Because I get a lot of that comment, that video, I still get questions about it. Of people saying it really resonated with me. I'm so grateful that it occurred to me to be honest about it.
Yeah, but it's scary to be honest.
It is.
Because you're showing a vulnerability or weakness or whatever it might be.
Yeah, totally.
I'm not going to talk to you anymore because I want to talk to you again about a whole bunch of other stuff. And I could talk to you all freaking
day. Yeah, we can keep on.
This is like so, but I want to do another, we got...
I'm coming to New York for Comic-Con.
All right, so then we're going to get together.
I'll be there for like a
week
and a half. Yeah, I'll be there for like 10 days.
We'll get together. And you haven't met my wife?
I met your son, but I'm not sure I met your wife.
Oh, wait. No, you did. They came to see you. Right. Yeah, they had a great time. Yeah, they had a great time at your show. And you got them. You were so sweet to them. Anyway, so great to be with you again.
Oh, I love doing this podcast.
And
you're an amazing interviewer.
Oh, thanks. I just have a lot of quirky interests. And the whole goal of the podcast is to expose people to sides of people that they think they know. And processes, and also processes that they don't know that they should know something about. And we just did an episode about the Emmy Awards with my acting coach and this director to talk about the history of the Emmys and what they really mean and why they should be taken with a grain of salt. And did you know the Academy Awards were started by Louis B. Mayer because he wanted someone to build his beach house for free? He wanted a beach house, but he wanted it built quickly. And all the people that he was talking to, the traditional builders, like said, it's going to be 8 months. And then he's like, wait a minute, I got all these set builders who build sets like that. So he's like, he goes, let's get the set builders over. And the set builder, apparently they were starting to talk about unionizing. So they're going, well, we can bring the set builders over, but you're going to have to pay them X. He goes, well, I don't want to pay them X. He goes, I know what I'll do. He goes, I'll make a group of the top creative people. It'll be a club. And we'll get together, and in exchange for not unionizing, I'll make sure that they get work and extra work. So he organized a club of like 30 to 40.
There's a lot of work to go through to get a fast, cheap summer.
Exactly.
House. I mean, Michael Caine went and did Jaws 3. It was, I think, a lot easier.
So he gathers together the top 30 or 40 creatives from the different disciplines, and they create the small club. And they have to give it a name, and they give it the National Academy of Motion Picture Arts and Sciences, which is complete horseshit. Right. And they meet literally like a country club, and that's their first meeting. And then they realize, well, Jesus, nobody knows about this. And somebody goes, well, maybe we should give some awards to each other, and then people will write about the awards. And that's how they came about.
Wow.
All for the money. But I don't know why we even went there, but we'll do this again. I'll see you in New York. This has been Adam Savage, and great human being and making a difference in the world. And thanks for being on the show again.
Thank you, man. Anytime.
All right. That was Adam Savage. Told you. Right? You could talk to him forever. We're going to have him on again. Go check him out online, on tour. He's everywhere doing really cool stuff. Please keep leaving comments and tell your friends to leave some comments on iTunes. Always good to get those. And spread the links around. Thanks for checking out the podcast, and we will see you next week.